Hello and welcome back to Tales from Wisteria Lane, the podcast where we give you a fair view of all things Desperate Housewives. We are the boyfriends. I'm Billy Ray.
And I'm Joel.
And today we are back with Season 7, Episode 1, Remember Paul.
Yes, we are. Finally, Season 7.
Yes, and obviously we have a returning cast member, but we'll get into all of that. So first we're going to start with some trivia from Joel. Yes. So go ahead.
There is a lot, because obviously it's opening episode of the season. So this episode aired on the 17th of October 2010 in the UK, and it aired on the 26th of September in the US. So it was a little bit early for you US guys, as UK people had to wait. The director was David Grossman, and the writer was Mark Cherry. So according to Cherry, he had intended for this series to conclude after the 7th season, but the 8th season ended up being the season's final one. So we are on the penultimate now. The series saw the lowest ratings in its history for the 7th season, with the premiere being outperformed by Sunday Night Football on NBC and Family Guy on Fox.
Oh, so we're at Family Guy's peak.
Yeah.
You know, it would have actually made sense for the whole show to end with Season 7, because it kind of bookends the entire show this season.
It does.
It would have been full circle.
At the time, the episode was the least watched season premiere of Desperate Housewives. The role of Penny Scarvo was recast, with Kendall Applegate being replaced by Darcy Rose Burns, which I didn't even notice.
Oh, nor did I. Sorry, Pendle.
Kendall.
Oh, Kendall. Sorry.
Who the fuck is Pendle?
Sorry, Candle.
This episode brings us a couple of new characters. One returning character, should I say. So we have the return of Mark Moses, who plays Paul Young, and we have the return of, well, not even the return, sorry, we have the inclusion of Renee Perry, who's played by Vanessa Williams. So I do have Vanessa Williams trivia, which I will do in episode, because it's a little bit more fun. But
I love Vanessa Williams.
Who doesn't love Vanessa Williams? She is incredible. So following the cast announcement, Williams admitted to having been a fan of the series during its first year, but stopped watching because of the racially insensitive second season mystery storyline, which focused on Betty Applewhite, the series' first black main character. Williams explained to Entertainment Weekly that Betty had her son in chains in the basement, and it was like, really, do we have to go there with our first black character? I honestly fell off the show after that. I think it was just so implausible and just an image that black folks don't want to see their child chained and shackled in the basement.
Oh, wow, that's a very good point, not one that I ever thought of.
Cast member Felicity Huffman commented on Williams' addition to the cast, saying, "She's such a great dash of vinegar to Wisteria Lane. It's going brilliantly. She's a wonderful woman, really smart. She's really strong and a real team player. She's a great addition."
I mean, that didn't sound like a compliment at first, but then after
the vinegar.
Yeah.
Yeah, I guess because, you know, vinegar just, you know, spices things up a little bit. The episode received mixed reviews, with Tanner Stransky of Entertainment Weekly, who did give a positive review. He praised Williams' performance, stating that she brought back a brand of bitchery that had been missing from the series since Nicolette Sheridan's departure. Additionally, he favourably compared the performance to Williams' portrayal of Wilhelmina Slater on Ugly Betty. He also complimented Harriet Sansom Harris's performance, naming her the creepiest character in the best possible way.
Is that Felicia Tillman?
Yeah.
Okay.
Stransky called the Gabrielle Carlos storyline sweet, but criticised the ridiculousness of Susan's.
You know, that's a good point. So, this first episode, I feel like nothing much really happens, so I can understand why someone would have very mixed to negative feelings.
Mm.
Although it's a great introduction and return of characters, and it's just setting stuff up, so I'll allow it.
It's setting stuff up, and if you're a diehard fan of Desperate Housewives, stuff does happen. Mm. We get Paul Young back. Felicia's in prison, but Felicia's talking about getting her revenge on Paul Young, and it's all coming, like B said earlier on, it's all coming full circle. So even though it feels like for the main four housewives, we're just kind of setting things up for what their storyline for the season is going to be, we do get something substantial, and we get a real interesting series mystery, especially with the way the episode ends.
Yeah, that's right.
Brenda Strong, who's Mary Alice Young, is seen in this episode, and it's her 14th on-screen appearance in the run of the series, and it's also the first season premiere to physically show her since the pilot.
Oh, wow. Okay.
And the name of this episode comes from the lyrics, "Getting Married Today" from Company.
Okay.
So on this day, the US number one song was Just the Way You Are by Bruno Mars, and the UK number one song was Forget You by CeeLo Green.
Oh yeah, I liked that song when it first came out.
AKA Gnarls Barkley.
I was really obsessed with that song.
It was a great song. And then Gwyneth Paltrow covered it in Glee. And so this week, there was only a couple of things in the news. There was tons of stuff that happened, but I really couldn't be bothered to go through it all. So I just picked a couple of bits. The Hobbit is set to be the most expensive movie ever, with the New Zealand company Wingnut Films waiting for the green light for its planned adaptation. And British pop singer George Michael is released from Suffolk prison after serving 4 weeks for driving while under the influence of cannabis.
Oh, George.
Yeah.
Come on now.
The rest of the trivia I'll have in-house, in episode.
All right then. So previously, it was revealed to Orson that Andrew hit and killed Juanita Solis Sr. with his car, and Bree refused to let Andrew go to prison for this crime, leading to Orson leaving Bree due to her hypocrisy.
Yeah.
Bree then told Gabby about this at the end of the episode, but we did not see her reaction.
No, we haven't.
A woman who worked in the hospital's maternity ward revealed on her deathbed that someone on Wisteria Lane is raising someone else's biological children without their knowledge, presumably due to an accidental child swap.
A mix-up of sorts, yeah.
And finally, Mike's debt led him and Susan selling their house and move into a flat outside of Wisteria Lane, and the new owner of the house that they used to live in is now Paul Young, who has returned to the lane. And that was quite the cliffhanger for the last season, I think.
It really was quite the cliffhanger.
We're going to start with Paul, and we're going to talk about him and maybe find out why he's not in prison.
Yeah.
Mary Alice narrates about her past happiness with Paul Young and family, hosting parties and basically living her suburban dream. Eventually, she received that infamous letter from Martha Huber that we all remember so clearly, leading to her suicide. Joel, what did that letter say?
I know what you did. It makes me sick. I'm going to tell.
Paul found out and killed Martha Huber. Martha's sister, Felicia Tillman, then framed Paul for murder, her own murder to be specific, and Paul was put in prison.
The opening of this episode really does make it feel like it's the beginning of the end.
It really does.
We have like the cuts and Mary Alice explaining everything, and it really feels like it feels like they had started writing this series with the intention of it being the last season.
That was the opening, and now let's move on to Paul's story. So, years later, a police officer pulls over a woman for speeding, and it turns out to be Felicia Tillman, and you can tell because she doesn't have some fingers. And it is uncovered that she indeed faked her own death, and Paul Young is released from prison. We see him talking to his lawyer about where he's going to go, and he says that he's going to be moving back to Wisteria Lane. Surely, if you are keeping a low profile because of your fake death, you wouldn't be speeding.
Right, speeding, that's what gets Felicia caught. Speeding.
Maybe she was doing 32 and a 30.
Yeah, I know, we've all been there, for fuck's sake. But honest to God, like, it's so good having Felicia back. I'm so happy.
We then see Karen looking pretty surprised to see Paul back on the lane, and Mary Alice says that he's going to make sure they never forget about him.
Well, he's clearly evil. He just stands on the lane and, like, smiles and waves really creepily.
Yeah, it's weird. So Paul invites the ladies into his home to tell the story of how he got out of prison and about Felicia being a mental person. Now, this must be particularly difficult for Susan to see him unpacking his stuff in her recently sold house.
Yeah.
In fact, she only just left. How long was she gone before she came back?
I don't know, because in the other scene that we have with Susan, like, they've literally only just walked in to their flat. So she can't have been there very long.
They seem sorry for not supporting him in the trial, but Paul is creepy as ever and just tells them that he is back to see his friends.
Like, we get it, Paul's butt hurt. We get it. But let's not act like you didn't kill someone, Paul, because you did.
Yeah, you may have gone to prison for the wrong crime, but you had the sentence for a crime that
you did commit. You did commit a crime. You just didn't go to prison for killing the right person.
Right. You went to prison for a murder and you committed a murder.
Yeah. So, and like, just let's stop acting butthurt about these women. How you're there, like, how could they believe me capable of murder? How could they? They never visited me. They were awful to me. I was innocent, goddammit. You still killed someone. They thought you were capable of murder because you're capable of murder.
Yeah. Paul visits Felicia in prison and they have a bit of a bitch-off session at each other, with Paul telling her how to get used to prison, and we have a clip.
I'm surprised you agreed to see me.
I wanted to spit in your face. I didn't realize there'd be glass.
That's right, you're not used to prison. Give yourself time. What is it now? 2 to 5 years?
18 months with good behavior. You're giving me a lot of reasons to be extremely well-behaved.
Maybe I can give you a few pointers on prison life. I become a bit of an expert thanks to you. Hey, here's one. It never hurts to tip the guard who does your cavity search.
Listen to me, you son of a bitch. I don't care what I have to do. I will see you behind bars again, or dead. Whichever is easier.
I wanted to spit in your face. I didn't realize there'd be glass.
Now that's the Felicia we remember.
Maybe we should start doing, like, favorite lines of the episode, because this is my favorite line of this entire episode.
Also notice in this scene that Paul is like really antagonizing Felicia, even towards the end when he puts the phone down so she can only lip read, and he basically says like, yeah, I killed her, or
Felicia says, I know you killed my sister, and then he says that's a crazy groundless accusation, and then he hangs up the like prison phone, and then he just looks Felicia in the eye behind the glass and then mouths, I did. So he knows full well, because what he says to Felicia in that scene is, they listen to what you're saying on the phone.
Yeah.
Like, you can't just sit there and be like, I will murder you on the phone to the man that you've been caught framing, because that's not going to look well. That's not going to be good behaviour, Felicia. No.
Later, Lee comes over to talk to Paul and moans that he didn't let him know that he had been in prison. And Paul says that he'll make it up to him by giving him more business by buying his old house back. So he wants two houses?
Well, he's renting Susan and Mike's, isn't he? He's not actually living in that. He's only rented Susan and Mike so he can get himself back on the lane.
That seems so much money.
Because he would have got a good payout from that 10-year wrongful incarceration.
True,
from the government. He would have been rich. So he's clearly got a good payout because he can afford to rent and buy his old house back.
Yeah.
He probably wasn't anticipating his old house being available. Paul does say something in this scene, which if I was Lee, would have raised a red flag. Because Lee was like, oh, why would you want to buy your old house? Like, because of all the happy memories, blah, blah, blah. And then Paul was like, I've had 10 years to work on this plan. And if I was Lee, I'd be like, what?
What do you mean? I've always said because of the happy memories, like your wife shooting herself in the head.
Like, plan? What the hell? What plan is this?
I mean, the happy memories things would raise alarms. It's like, you didn't...
No, Lee said the happy memories.
Oh, sorry. That makes more sense. And that is the end of Paul's story. So he's bought two houses. We don't really know why yet, do we?
No, not yet.
It's just curious.
We know he's got a plan that he's been sitting there stewing on for 10 fucking years, but...
Now, let's move on to Susan. Susan and fam show up to their new flat, and MJ is instantly displeased and recognises that they are povo, even though Susan tries to convince him that they're actually just lower middle class.
Mm. And the flat doesn't actually look too bad. It's quite nice.
It looks okay. I think it looks perfectly reasonable as like a starter home for sure.
Yeah, and instead of talking to MJ about your financial situation, maybe you should explain the concept of privilege to this child, because he's clearly got it.
Yeah, well, I mean, his first house ever was gorgeous.
Yeah, and then he turns up and then Susan's like, oh, poor people wish they could live like this. And MJ's like, they shouldn't.
It's used for laughs, but yeah, maybe we should teach that out of him, right?
Mm.
Then they try and cheer him up and say it's all going to be fine, but MJ's not buying any of it. She's then interrupted by a phone call to say that Paul Young has returned to the lane. And then we have, all of the stuff with the Paul Young talking about how he got out of prison.
Mm.
So, later, after she's met up with Paul again, she goes downstairs to meet the owner of her block of flats, Maxine, to give the late security deposit. And Maxine invites her in for tea after hearing that she's having money problems. And they discuss finances, and Maxine talks about her business that she built after her husband passed away. She then says that Susan would be great at the job and shows her what her employees do. And it seems to be like a webcam video website.
It's softcore porn.
Yeah, where we see women doing housework and lingerie.
Vavavabroom.com. Now, I must say that the website's a bit awkward. Like, you need something simple to remember and type. People looking for porn don't want to type out an essay to get it. Vavavabroom.com. And it's not even just vavava, it's va-va-broom.com. Like, it's an essay to write. Nobody wants to write that when they're looking for porn. But apparently there seems to be a market for women doing housework and sexy clothes.
I think there's always going to be a market for women doing anything in laundry, to be honest.
Yeah.
So Susan is disgusted at first and says no, and not just because it's va-va-va-broom. Maxine tries to convince her by showing her how much that she could make in just a week. And this nearly works, but Susan does do a walkout.
And Maxine also explains in this scene that most of her clients are from abroad.
Mm.
From abroad, okay? So most of your clients probably don't even speak English as their first language. Mm. And you're having your website called Va-Va-Va-Broom.
Mm-hmm.
And you're expecting me to believe that people from Eastern countries get Va-Va-Va-Broom. You know, the pun was gold, but everything else it's a zero from me, not so much.
Fair enough. Susan comes home to the flat to find a sad Mike talking about his bank loan and how it was rejected, so he can't hire a helper for his business. He then says that there's a job in Alaska that he could go for, and Susan obviously hates the idea, but he says there's no good options here.
Sorry, but Susan and Mike's idea for getting out of financial difficulties was to borrow more money.
Mm, but it's not their fault.
No, it's not their fault. It's not their fault.
The problem is that these loan companies and the banks are quite predatory with this shit.
Yeah, of course, like, they are
fully aware that all of these American working class people are getting in debt because of the shitty system they have.
Yeah.
I mean, the freaking, like, having the whole health insurance bollocks for one thing.
Mm.
And so their only option is to borrow money so that they don't become homeless.
Yeah.
And it's the cycle, isn't it?
It's a horrible cycle. And
Susan then asks him to give her a month before making a decision to see if she can get some money through her jewelry business.
Oh, those bits of jewelry. Oh.
But we got to her talking to Maxine, the landlady, and accepting the web video job.
Yeah.
And the jewelry's going to come up.
Yeah, we'll talk about the jewelry when we see more of it.
Poor Susan really thinks that she can, like, hock off this jewelry.
Even in Susan's story, MJ's shitty about the jewelry. Susan's like, and don't forget, Mum's going to start to sell some of that super cool jewelry she's been making. MJ just goes, oh, God.
Yeah.
They've made him extra sassy now that they've made MJ poor.
But also, he's grown up with Susan. And yeah. So I think he's... Well, I mean, we've grown tired of Susan sometimes.
Oh, absolutely. Definitely.
Poor MJ. He knows what he's in for.
Yeah.
Now let's talk about Lynette. Lynette is having trouble with a loud and demanding family of children and teenagers who are being loud and demanding that she buy stuff from the supermarket.
Mm.
But as she is holding a newborn baby, she basically tells them to either do it themselves or wait.
The family is so lazy, especially Tom. Like, I expect it from kids. Kids forget themselves sometimes, and they do this, and they expect their parents to do everything. Tom, I do not expect this from. Like, bitch, your wife was just held hostage and had to give birth without any medical help, which I imagine was agony. Like, you go to the shop.
Yeah, but we're not going to mention the whole hostage thing. It never comes up.
No, it really doesn't. No one ever talks about it.
We then get a phone call from Lynette's rich friend, Renee, who apparently always shows Lynette a great time, but the happiness is short-lived, as apparently she's coming to Lynette's crappy child-ridden home instead of her going to Renee's super awesome rich people place.
Yeah, her penthouse in the sky in New York.
Yeah, this leads to a, let's call it a family shuffle, where everyone is instructed to help turn the dump site into a clean space, and she then gets interrupted by the ladies telling her that Paul Young has returned.
Yeah, and so I guess she goes to Paul Young's house with the rest of the ladies and leaves her husband and the kids to continue cleaning the house because she gets distracted with other gossip.
And you know what, good for her, because these people, this family are horrible today.
I don't blame her at all.
So Renee then shows up and gets out of her fancy-ass car, and it's Vanessa Williams.
It's a limo.
Okay, her limo, which is a car.
Yes, I know, but you can't brush it off as a fancy-ass car. That could be like a Mercedes or something, or like with a top down. Bitch gets out of it. She pulls up on the lane in a limo. Now that is an entrance, and you were just about to glaze over it.
Yeah, I was.
Vanessa Williams got the entrance into the Wisteria Lane that she bloody well deserved. So, Renee Perry, aka Vanessa Williams. She's a lot of things, this woman. My trivia for her is all over the place. But as an actress, she enjoyed success on stage and screen, and she made her Broadway debut in 1994 with Kiss of the Spider Woman. In 2002, she starred as the witch in the revival of Stephen Sondheim's Into the Woods, which earned her a Tony Award for Best Actress in a Musical nomination.
Yeah, she does sing pretty well too.
She does. Mm. She starred in the revival of Horton Foote's The Trip to Bountiful in 2013 and the ensemble political farce POTUS, or Behind Every Great Dumbass, Seven Women Trying to Keep Him Alive in 2022. Most known for Desperate Housewives and Ugly Betty as Wilhelmina Slater, she's had guest appearances in Phineas and Ferb, Modern Family, and she's done voice work as Amanda Waller in some Batman and Suicide Squad bits and in the Studio Ghibli movie When Marnie Was There.
Mm.
So she was born in the Bronx, New York City, with a birth announcement that read, "Here she is, Miss America."
What?
Now, remember that, because my next point of trivia is Vanessa Williams gained recognition as the first African-American woman to receive the Miss America title when she was crowned Miss America in 1984. She resigned after leaked nude photos surfaced in Penthouse magazine. The centerfold model for that issue was 16-year-old Tracy Lords, and because Ms. Lords was underage, it's actually illegal to own or trade that issue of the Penthouse magazine unless the centerfold pictorial has been removed.
Mm-hmm.
32 years later, Williams was offered a public apology during the Miss America 2016 pageant for the event.
Did she accept it?
She did. Vanessa Williams rebounded from the scandal with success in a career as a singer and an actress. In 1988, she released her debut studio album, The Right Stuff, whose title single saw moderate success, as well as Dreamin', which peaked at number 8 in the United States in 1989. With her second and third studio albums, The Comfort Zone and The Sweetest Days, she saw continued commercial success and received multiple Grammy Award nominations. This included her number one single and signature song, Save the Best for Last. And finally, you will recognize her as the singer of Colors of the Wind in the credits of Disney's Pocahontas.
Yeah, the pop version of a Disney song.
She was the original pop. Well, she probably wasn't the original.
No.
But for me, she was the original. Yeah. She was the first one I remembered. So Vanessa Williams is a wonderful woman. She's had one hell of a career. She's been a pioneer. Well done, Miss Vanessa Williams. It is an honour to have you.
She's definitely the kind of lady that takes no prisoners.
And, oh, yeah.
That is quite the neighbour of the season, especially after having Edie leave and then unfortunately also losing Angie.
Yeah.
So she makes her entrance looking fab and then introduces all of the fam and the new daughter and then shows Renee inside. So Renee subtly slags off Lynette's house, calling it cozy and intimate.
We say cozy.
And Lynette gives it all back, but the kids seem to think that they're just being rude.
This is called reading. Like, kids, this is... I love how taken aback the kids are. But this is what it's like for friends.
Lynette and Renee are acting like the gays and the gals.
Yeah.
And they're having a royal joke, a good old laugh. And freaking Porter Preston twin person is like, Mom!
Yeah, it's like, Mom, calm down.
I was like, what did she say? She's joking. Chill out.
Exactly. I swear to God. And then these kids just cause problems.
Yeah. Funnily, Renee says that her life is a fantasy, but what Lynette has is real. And then, when she says that she hasn't booked a hotel, the boys suggest that she stays with them, much to Lynette's chagrin.
Yeah.
But Renee's sort of delighted.
Ooh, a sleeper sofa. I'm one of the ants.
Yeah, basically, Renee is going to have a really good time just, what's the word, sort of imitating poor people.
Yeah, she's Renee's entering her Amish era now. She's like, do you know what? Yeah, I'm going to churn some butter, mow the lawn, I don't know, wash my own underwear. Oh, it's going to be fun.
Yeah, Renee is completely just in her own world.
Absolutely.
Which she reveals so many times in the episode. Like, the way that she thinks Lynette lives like, the reality of it, she doesn't have a clue.
Yeah, no, not the one.
No. The next day, Susan brings her homemade jewelry around to the other ladies to see if they want to buy it, and this is a running gag throughout the episode, as we've discussed. Susan's horrible, tacky, homemade, clunky jewelry.
It really is. Like, how about Gabby? She has big, strong Latino ears.
Yeah, we all make choices, but that was a choice.
But then Gabby gets her back by saying, I'll buy this for Brie and her strong Protestant neck.
Yeah.
And then she has that, like, awful, disgusting, chunky necklace. Like, this beginning part of the scene is a masterclass in subtle reading.
Yep. So we have Lynette introduce the ladies to Renee, and we have a clip.
Oh, hey, here she is. Okay. Susan, Bree, Gabby, this is my old college roommate, Renee.
Hi, it is so nice to finally meet you. Lynette has talked so much about her friend from college.
Ah, yes. You know how in school the pretty girls always hang out together? Well, I refuse to go along with that. Renee comes off a little stuck up when you first meet her, which is a real time saver. Sit down.
I just love those reads.
There were so many more as well.
Yeah, like, don't have time to keep them all in.
No, Susan said something like, oh, they tell us what Lynette was like in college. And then she was like, oh, absolutely fearless. She just kept wearing those parachute pants. Lesbian rumors be damned.
But my God, Lynette gives it back.
She absolutely does give it back.
They continue to tease each other and make the ladies quite uncomfortable because apparently no one has ever seen any reading. And this is how you know we're in middle-class suburban white America.
Right, and Gabby, come on. You were a model in New York and you don't get reading.
Oh, and this is also when we find out that Renee is married to a famous football player.
Baseball player.
Baseball. She's a sport.
Yeah.
Renee then goes a step too far for Lynette by making a joke about how she was voted the most likely to succeed with an aww and a friendly pat on Lynette's shoulder.
Yeah, that didn't go down too well.
Sadly, Renee cannot recover from this and she continues digging herself a hole deeper and deeper, causing Lynette to snap back and say that Renee gets all of her money from men.
Yeah, success can't be defined. Like, what one person considers failure, someone else may consider success.
Yeah, I wouldn't say Lynette's failed in anything, to be honest. Like, she's had some really high-profile jobs. She's got an entire family.
She's had a successful career and built a family. Yeah. I say built a family, you know what I mean?
Constructed
a family. Yeah. So that's very successful, but Renee is still there digging that hole. She's like, it's just hard for me to reconcile this suburban housewife with a woman who had a threesome with two of the guys from the rugby team.
Yep. She struggles to see Lynette in this way when comparing her to Alphaeus that she was in college, using the threesome example, as Tom walks in and hears all of that.
Yeah, Tom walked in at the wrong moment.
They don't play it up too much, but it does come up again. So,
and all the other housewives, let's not forget, were also there when Renee said that, and they were gagged.
Yeah. She talks about this later that night with Tom, who seems really confused and bothered by the threesome story, and he convinces Lynette to talk to Renee about how she feels. Lynette then brings Renee a phone book and tells her to go to a hotel, basically. Renee then says that she doesn't think Lynette's life is pathetic and admits that her husband is leaving her after cheating on her.
With his agent's assistant.
Yeah, not even the agent.
Not even the agent. That's literally what I wrote. Like, not, I'd be so insulted. Like, bitch, babe, if you're going to cheat on me, you cheat up.
So she then shows her appreciation by offering to pay for Lynette's first facelift, which is where that episode ends. Now, let's move on to Bree's story. Bree tells Gabby that Andrew ran over Juanita Solis in his car all those years ago, very much to Gabby's surprise, who seems to develop a stomachache from this bad news, much like Chidi from The Good Place or something.
Yeah, that's true.
Gabby hates receiving this news and worries that Carlos finding out would lead to him killing Andrew and going to prison. But Bree says this due to worrying about being a bad person, but Gabby doesn't care about this and wishes that she had never told her.
Well, yeah, she's like, well, just so you know, Orson's divorcing me because he says I'm a bad person. I'm like, bitch, please. I agree with Gabby. That's your reason for telling me? You've kept this secret for 10 years.
Yeah, Gabby's like, I don't care about it. This conversation is interrupted by Karen knocking on the door to tell them that Paul Young has returned to the lane, which is a sentence that I've written all of their stories.
But I also, what I do find interesting is obviously Sam threatened to tell the Solises about Andrew doing this, and so Bree gave up her company for it. Bree's now just gone and told Gabby, so she's just given her company up for nothing.
I think it's also because he would have made sure that Andrew went to prison.
Maybe. Oh, that's possibly true.
But I understand what you mean. It almost feels like it was somewhat not worth it.
Yeah, not really.
Cut to that night and we see Orson's moving out with the help of his physical therapist. He asks if Bree's going to be okay, but she relays her current predicament of getting divorced and wondering why she ever quit drinking.
And then Orson decides he wants to slot his two cents into how Bree should feel right now.
Yes, he tells her she needs a project, which she refuses, and she sees it as a way to avoid confronting her emotions, and Orson kindly tells her that whatever she does choose to do will be spectacular.
Shut up, Orson.
This is probably the nicest breakup scene that I've ever seen.
Yeah, it just really irritated me. I was just like, thank you for your two cents into how I should feel right now, Orson, but can you go away, please?
I guess it's because he's not leaving her because he doesn't love her, he hates her. It's just a question of moral standing at this point.
But at the end of season six, I'm pretty sure Orson's room was empty.
Yeah, I thought he'd already moved out.
Yeah, because Andrew came in and he was like, where's Orson's stuff gone?
I guess it's just the last few boxes, maybe?
Maybe.
Like, the things that you have to sort out between you. That's always an awkward thing, isn't it?
And as we know, there isn't that much of a big gap between the end of season six and the beginning of season seven, really. There's, like, hours between them.
If
that, yeah.
He leaves, then she looks at all of the pictures of family members, including the painting from her wedding with Rex, and I'm still convinced of that.
It's not a painting.
It's a painting.
No, it's not. I swear to God, it is not a painting. Motherfucker, we need to get Mark Cherry on this right now. I'm done with this.
What was the last season that we mentioned that?
Probably two or three. I'm going to say two.
Yeah, it's a painting.
It's not a fucking painting.
And then Bree notices the wallpaper peeling and decides to tear it all down.
I mean, it's time to get rid of the wallpaper anyway, Bree. Yeah. Let's face it.
The next day, and following the scene where Gabby tells Bree that she refuses to tell Carlos about Andrew running over his mother, but we'll get to that, Bree has a hot decorator over, and he says that she should go for a bold colour, and after Bree first suggests a deep beige...
which is where I get it from all the time. Mmm, yes. How about a nice deep beige?
Yeah. Which he says to go bolder, and maybe go for, like, scarlet red. Orson then comes over with some papers to sign.
Yeah, and Bree's like, please don't take offence, but I'm going to be serving dinner in here, not sailors.
Yeah. So she signs the papers and tells him about having a dinner with Andrew, and his physical therapist reminds him that they have a wine tasting to go to that night. So he then admits to Bree that him and Judy are now in a relationship.
I mean, he moved on quickly, and yeah. Bree did mention this to him, but she can't exactly take the high road here.
No.
She hadn't even broken up with Orson and she'd moved on.
Yeah, that's true. So apparently Judy had feelings for him before and was waiting to get with him after the separation. And Bree's a bit annoyed because it has only been a week, so she didn't wait that freaking long.
Right, and like when Orson wanted a divorce, he got it. But when Bree wanted one, it wasn't allowed. Like, Orson forced her to stay.
Yeah, imagine if she pulled that card on him.
Like, I would literally just, I would have mentioned it right there. And then if I was Bree, I'd be like, no, go fuck yourself.
Yeah, true. So she then goes back in and the decorator has some more ideas. He says that Bree would look hot with the red hair against the new colour choice. And Bree seems to consider shagging him.
I don't blame her. Who doesn't love a guy and a wife beater?
Yeah, he did look pretty good.
There is something sort of rugged and dirty and bad boy-esque about Keith. I find Keith incredibly hot.
Maybe it's the confidence to have your armpit hair out on display at all times.
Yes, probably.
And maybe. Your nipples showing at all times.
Yeah.
Now, let's move on to Gabby. So, we see people delivering news and we get a tech throwback with an old BlackBerry phone.
Yeah, and someone, shout out to the consistency here, with someone DMing someone in the opening scene on Silver Fizz.
Oh yes, which
has not been mentioned since season 5.
Ugh, wow.
When Lynette tries to catfish her son.
Yeah. Yeah, so I love an old tech throwback.
Yeah.
Apparently though, some news needs to be delivered in person, and we cut to the hospital people who want a man to go to Wisteria Lane and tell the family involved about the biological baby swap incident.
Yes, the man from the end of the last episode of last season.
That's right. So the man from the hospital goes to Wisteria Lane and has a conversation with Carlos and tells them that the nurse who delivered their baby had a drinking problem and apparently their daughter Juanita and someone else's daughter was accidentally swapped at birth. And Carlos tells the guy that he will tell Gabby about this himself and says it's going to destroy her.
Yeah. I don't know what's more disgusting. The whole Juanita isn't really Gabby's daughter thing or the fact that Carlos is facial hair free.
Oh yeah, that's a new thing, isn't it?
Yes, it is a new thing. Not that he looks bad.
He does look good, but...
I prefer him with the goatee. I think he looks sexier with the goatee.
Not a goatee, but I like when he has facial hair. I don't like goatees.
I have a goatee from time to time.
I know, but you look nice.
You can't just suddenly backtrack now, bitch.
I'm not backtracking.
Yes, you are. You've just said, I don't like goatees, and now you're saying, but you look nice. No, 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 I get it. I understand. Don't worry about it. Fuck me. Fuck my drag.
So, Carlos is going through family photos when Juanita comes in, and they talk about his mum, Juanita, and how great she was, and how Juanita is named after her. Gabby hears this in the background and is probably feeling awful, considering what Bree has told her, and offers to take Juanita to bed. So Gabby and Juanita, they have a nice moment as she tucks her in and says Juanita is her whole world. And Carlos hears this conversation whilst in the background, probably feeling awful considering what the lawyers told him. So everyone's feeling awful.
Yeah, and I like that they're both keeping this a secret from each other.
Yeah,
it means a secret that... about a Juanita Solis, weirdly enough.
Oh yeah, that's true. That is interesting. I guess when they both find out that the other one's been lying, it's like, call it even.
Yeah, pretty much. Okay.
Carlos then goes to the hospital with a couple of options. Number one, sue them. Or number two, to make this all go away and never let Gabby find out about the whole thing. The lawyer says it's almost impossible to stop as it's all getting out, but Carlos says it's going to kill Gabby and refuses to let her know. And this is just a very interesting way of handling it.
Like, this affects the other family as well. Mm. So you can't take that choice away from them by keeping this quiet.
That's the thing. You can say, I don't want you to tell Gabby. Gabby never will find out. But if the other family do get involved and want to see their biological daughter, it's all going to come out.
But that's it. That's why Carlos has gone to the hospital, because he's saying you need to stop the search for the other family. You stopping the search for the other family is effectively stopping the other family from knowing this as well. And they may want to know this.
But he just wants to protect Gabby, doesn't he?
He does, yeah.
We then cut to Gabby, who is telling Bree that she refuses to tell Carlos about Andrew killing his mum. So Gabby's also going a very similar route about this.
Yeah.
She says that they've had rough times, but things are great at the moment, and she doesn't want to change that right now. Mm. Gabby, you can't just avoid rough times in your life, even when they're all coming at once.
True. I don't know. Like, I disagree with the way that Carlos is handling the situation, but a part of me doesn't disagree with the way Gabby is handling it, because that was 10 years ago and Carlos has moved on from the loss of his mother and they are working as a family and things are going really well, and to bring it all back up and to reopen that wound, I think is something that really needs to be considered.
You make a very good point, because morally and ethically it's a very complicated situation. Everyone's moved on.
You can tell B's rewatching The Good Place.
Yes, I am rewatching The Good Place. Yeah, he's moved on. No good can come from it, really, other than just causing a barrage of awkwardness with Bree and Andrew. And we've seen that he has a temper, so it's like only negativity can come from it, but also is it not...
Does he not have a right to know because it's his mother?
Yeah, and does Bree not have the responsibility to tell him?
Yeah, so, and Carlos deserves that closure as well. He deserves to know.
So let's move on to the very end of the episode. Bree is distracted by her hot decorator. Susan is shown wearing lingerie whilst doing housework.
Really lackluster as well.
What, as in Susan the way that she's not, doing the lingerie?
Yeah, Susan's not enjoying the cleaning in lingerie. She's like covering herself up and sort of half-heartedly dusting. It's really bad.
Yeah, so she's got, we'll call it her trial period. Gabby and Carlos have breakfast together and are drowning in their lies.
Drowning in their lies.
And Felicia is in prison looking at a photo of Paul from the newspaper, bonding with her new cellmate, telling her that he's going to receive the punishment he's entitled to. Apparently, he'll be dead within 6 months, even though she's going to be in here for at least 2 years. She then says Paul doesn't have friends on that street, but she does.
Felicia really does like to flap her gums behind bars, doesn't she?
Yeah, she's got a real problem. How was she not caught like years ago?
Right.
But before we end the episode, 2 years. I'm not so sure if I agree with this. So she goes to prison for 2 years, but can possibly get let out on good behaviour.
For 18
Did
months.
Did she really get past some sort of psychological like check and she didn't have to go to a mental institution or something?
Well, I think it's quite a brutal system for Paul being incarcerated for 10 years for a murder he didn't commit, and for the person whose murder he was supposed to have committed to only get 2 years for the framing. Like, I find that she gets 20% of the time that he got
it doesn't
in
make
prison.
Sense. And how is she not in a mental institution? She faked her own death and she cut off her fingers.
Yeah, cutting off the fingers was a bit odd.
This whole story is just bonkers. I can't believe that how lightly she's got off, really.
Yeah.
So let's move on to our next part of the episode where Joel's going to give the gayest and the straightest moment. So what do you have for the gayest moment of the episode?
My award for gayest moment. It's a joint award. It goes to Renee and Lynette.
Is it for the reading?
It's for the reader, for their friendship in general. It's a very gay friendship, like the gays and the girls. We have friendships like that.
Yeah, the people that read, we get it.
We get it. We get the reading.
We thought it was funny and mostly harmless.
Oh, yeah. I mean, and there's always one person that does take it too far.
And then what do you have for straightest moment?
I don't actually have one.
You don't have one?
No, I don't have one. There wasn't really anything that screamed straight. The only person I could think of giving it to was Tom.
Well, it was written by Mark Sherry. So.
Yeah, but there was nothing that screamed straight to me, so I didn't hand out a straightest moment award.
Okay.
Now we move on to B's awards for best and worst parent. So who do you have for the best parent?
So my award for...
best parent of the episode.
I gave this to Gabby for her sweet moment with Juanita when tucking her in bed and basically saying that she is her whole world. I thought it was a really sweet thing to... It was a sweet moment.
Yeah, it was
nice. I liked
nice.
The moment. And there wasn't really much else to go off of. That was particularly great.
So who do you have for the worst parent of the episode?
My award for...
worst parent of the episode.
I give this one to Tom for being so confused that Lynette might actually do less around the house now that she's got a newborn baby to take care of.
Yeah, now that she's holding a newborn in her arms, yes.
And she was just a hostage, but I'm going to assume that he doesn't know. He doesn't even offer to help at all in the moment.
No, I imagine he doesn't know.
But I find it weird that not only does he not... Well, he doesn't offer to help. He doesn't even call up the kids for how they're talking to their mum. He's just like, really? You're not going to do anything?
Yeah.
Like, you don't take the kids' side when they're being rude.
He joins in with the kids.
That's so weird.
Yeah.
He's one of the boys. He's one of the girls, one of the boys. So, yeah, Tom, you are the worst parent of this episode. Congratulations. The first one of season 7.
I know, and chances are, I think, actually, Tom may have some of the worst parent, like, most of the worst parent awards.
What, in the season?
In general.
Oh, wow.
Overall, so far as to what we've done.
Maybe when we do our very last episode, I'll count them up.
Maybe, yeah.
I'll do a tally.
We might have to.
And that is the end of the episode. So, that was season 7, episode 1, Remember Paul? If anyone has any questions, queries, comments and theories, where can they find us?
You can find us on Instagram at Boyfriends Review.
And that's all.
Yeah.
We also have email, which is boyfriendsreview@outlook.com, because we're so trendy. Yeah. And all of our artwork, including the brand new one for this episode, was done by our friend Louis at DocRedMonkDesign on Instagram, where he also has a link to his Etsy page. Join us next week when we'll be back in your ear holes with Season 7, Episode 2, You Must Meet My Wife.
You Must Meet My Wife.
Yeah.
Yes, we'll see you then, guys.
See you then. Bye.
Bye.